Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Ben Swanson here with you, along with our friend Andrew Mason and columnist.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you for joining us again. The NFL annual meeting just wrapped up, a.k.a. the owners' meetings. Always a hotbed for changing rules, looking forward to where the game is going, things that go behind closed doors as far as TV, broadcast, stuff like that. Just kind of trying to get the pulse on where the NFL is headed and advancing the league. And also a nice time to sit down with the coach for a good while, and you got to hear a lot more of where he sees this team going, about the direction, the transition in the offense. And to no surprise, a lot of that was centered on the young players, about their burgeoning roles that he sees and the importance of that to where this team goes.
Yeah, a few more specifics from Kubiak when he had his press gathering at the coach's breakfast Tuesday morning, which was close to an hour in length. You know, you go back to the combine last month, and both Gary Kubiak and John Elway were making it clear that a lot of what the Broncos were going to do going forward to replace their free agent losses was going to be based around young players. But, Kubiak spoke about the offensive line. He talked about where Michael Schofield, Matt Paradis, Ben Garland, and Shelly Smith, who they signed as a street free agent earlier this month. He's not an old player either. He's a young guy who still has some upside. Talked about where they might end up fitting in on the offensive line, which really only has two spots set right now. Left tackle Ryan Clady, right guard Luis Vasquez. The other three positions are wide open. Also talked a lot about Cody Latimer and the role he's going to have going forward as the Broncos. They lose a big target in Julius Thomas. They did bring in Owen Daniels. They did keep Virgil Green, but you're going to want to make up for that production somewhere. And with Wes Welker unsigned, and it seems unlikely he's going to be back at this point, it looks like Cody Latimer's looking at getting a much heavier workload than he had last year. And frankly, they think he's ready for it. Remember, they traded up to get Cody Latimer last year. That's why the Broncos did not have the fourth-round pick of their own in this year's draft. They end up getting a compensatory pick at the end of the fourth round, of course. But they did not have that fourth-rounder because they moved up in round two to get Latimer. That tells you what John Elway feels about Latimer. And Gary Kubiak has spoken about how he's high on Latimer and what he can do in the offense. So really, it's just making things a little more concrete about the young players having a bigger role. That being said, on the offensive line, I think it's going to kind of be something they feel out on a week-to-week and even month-to-month basis in the off season. And if they don't like the progression of the young guys during OTAs, and that would include any draft picks they add at the end of April and the beginning of May, then you could see them dip back into the market perhaps in early June, after June 1, which is, and after that, if you sign unrestricted free agent, doesn't count toward the calculation for compensatory picks next year. Then you could see them maybe add some guys to supplement and be an insurance policy. But for now, they seem pretty confident in what they have.
To quote Kubiak, he said they expect a big jump from Latimer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Latimer is a guy who was very experienced in big jumps. He had some very flashy catches in the training camp last year. Mm-hmm. I think when you come into a offense like the Broncos last year, led by a quarterback like Peyton Manning, you're going to have a bit of a slow learning curve. They expected a lot last season. They expected to go far. That's obviously going to be an offense that needs a lot from its veteran presences. So Latimer was going to be a little bit behind. Especially two Pro Bowlers like Sanders and Demaryius.
And then, yeah, I mean, Welker had double-digit touchdowns in 2013, so he was still expected to be a part of the offense. And, of course, Cody Latimer is not a natural slot receiver, even though I think you'll see some repetitions in the slot, and he made a play against Dallas in the preseason finale running out of an inside slot position. So he can do that from time to time. But with those three guys, Demaryius Thomas, Emmanuel Sanders, Wes Welker, and then when they need a breather, they went with Andre Caldwell, a.k.a. Bubba, because he had more experience in the system. But at the same time, with Cody Latimer, his upside is pretty tantalizing. And he's only going to get better with that on-field experience. You kind of get the sense from John Elway that he wanted more young guys to play a part in the team last year. That when everything went to hell at right tackle over the course of the first half of the season, and they went through two guys, and eventually they used Luis Vasquez at right tackle. You got the sense that maybe he wanted Michael Schofield to get a look last year because that's a natural position for him, or maybe even Cody Latimer to get a look when Wes Welker was down, and you saw Andre Caldwell kind of picking up repetitions, that maybe he wanted to see Cody Latimer get more opportunities. Well, they're both of them are going to have them, but certainly right now, Latimer looks like barring an injury, that you can put him in pen as the Broncos' number three receiver. And yes, you're going to merge Gary Kubiak's offense with Peyton Manning's. Yes, you're going to see some two tight end sets and some sets with a fullback, but there's going to be plenty of three wide sets as well because they're going to want to play to the offense's personnel strengths. And even with Cody Latimer having a lack of experience, I think the offense's personnel strength is in a three wide set with him out there.
Now on the defensive side, Kubiak did talk a little bit about the 3-4 transition, the linebacking group, and he wrote an article on the site about how that transition might be a little bit slow going mm-hmm. with Danny Trevathan recovering from injury and Brandon Marshall recovering from his Liz Frank, which is something that might go a little bit under the radar because he did play in that final playoff game, so people might
but
not...
But played through a lot of pain. Right. That's something that he made clear after the game. I mean, really, you look back at Brandon Marshall in that playoff game playing as much as he did, and it was an under the radar, almost heroic effort on his part to play as much as he did. But Sisyphean would have been like pushing the boulder up the hill and then having it come back down. If he'd done it over multiple weeks and was not having any progression in the healing, that definitely would have been Sisyphean, I would say. But the thing with Liz Frank is, once you go through the rehab, but rest is a key to recovering from that. Ryan Clady had a more serious Liz Frank injury in 2013. And even by 2014, he wasn't back to where he was. He said to me at the Pro Bowl, he didn't really start feeling like himself until toward the end of the season, of the 2014 season.
Is that kind of surprising that he didn't feel that way until the end of the season, once he got like even more?
Not when it's that severe like that. And just take a look at Darren McFadden, who to this day has not been the same since his Liz Frank injury. Now, being a running back as opposed to a tackle, the demands you're placing on the foot and the bones involved in that area are different. So it was going to have much more of an effect on McFadden, but certainly it had an effect on him. Champ Bailey had a Liz Frank injury in the 2013 preseason. Eventually tried to come back later in the season. Never the same. So you've got an off season of rest and rehab is the best thing for Brandon Marshall, because instead of trying to force his way back like Champ Bailey did throughout the 2013 season, kept trying to come back and kept having one and had one setback after another with the foot, and to the point where when he went to New Orleans the following offseason, didn't even have enough left in the tank to make the team. If the Broncos are cautious with Brandon Marshall, they have a good chance of being able to avoid that fate. But caution means he will probably miss some practice time. And as Gary Kubiak said, both with Marshall and Trevathan coming off the three injuries around his left knee, they're going to get mental reps. It's not going to be on field full speed or even half speed type stuff when the Broncos go through OTAs. So, As the cliche goes, the Chinese have the same word for crisis as they do for opportunity. And Homer Simpson would say, yes, crisis-tunity. That's an opportunity for Steven Johnson to get some more reps on the inside, and it's an opportunity for Todd Davis, Lamine Barrow, Corey Nelson, all to work on the inside, and for at least one of them to probably step up and assert themselves as an insurance policy in case one of those two starting inside linebackers has an injury at or a recurrence of their injury at some point. You'd say probably Todd Davis has the inside track because he started at weak side linebacker late in the 2014 season. But they still have high hopes for Barrow and Nelson, who saw some playing time. Both of whom saw some decent playing time in spurts last year.
Now it's tough waiting right now because we don't have any football activities really going on, and they can't do any football activities together until I think April 13th. I think is the day.
And even then, it really
two streams cross.
That's when they start workouts, and it's when they can start meetings. But those first couple weeks of off-season work, you can't even work with a football. At least with team organized type stuff. So
basketball,
yeah, or soccer balls. They use soccer balls in practice sometimes. So really, we won't get a good sense of where they are until you get to May, when you start having the full team work in the helmets, the sessions that we covering the team can watch. And we'll get a feel for what's going on out there. The coaches will get a feel, and then they'll react to it.
Now, one of the things, I'm going to make a bit of a sharp cut here. Last week we kind of discussed Greg Hardy's signing with the Cowboys, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago. Obviously controversial. I mean, the history with him is difficult to talk about. And frankly, it's difficult to talk about sports sometimes when it involves athletes in legal and criminal troubles. And it's tough to discuss fandom in the intersection of that. Greg Hardy was found guilty of domestic violence against an ex-girlfriend and with a pile of firearms in his apartment. They went to trial. He was convicted, appealed, and then the survivor did not appear at the appeal, and so the thing was just all dropped. Greg Hardy, of course, only played one game the whole season before being placed on the
commissioner's exempt list.
Yes.
Which meant he got paid.
Got paid, didn't play. Mm. And obviously this comes at a time where domestic violence is a huge issue, not only for the league, but it's one of these issues that are becoming much more noticeable, getting much more attention as women's issues are. And frankly, once it all drops, it puts us at a very weird intersection of, a very serious crime that has no resolution, frankly. And how you take a very talented football player, and do you sign this guy? This is an awkward position to put people who might be working with him, people who might be cheering for him.
Well, it's interesting because those two, Greg Hardy and Ray McDonald, were signed, and Ray Rice is unsigned. It's been speculated in the media, oh, well, there's video on one and not the other two, and that makes a difference. But it shouldn't make a difference. It should. That just because we have one captured on camera and the others, it just happened privately. It shouldn't mean that it's perceived any differently on our part. Now, some of that, there may be a football aspect to it, and McDonald and Hardy probably have more left in the tank than Ray Rice, who was slipping before the injury. But nevertheless, I mean, it's interesting to see how teams react to that, and it's interesting to see the public react to it as well. Not only these guys, I get asked about Adrian Peterson a lot. Adrian Peterson, a convicted child abuser. Mm-hmm. I was sifting through the questions for my mailbag that's going to run on Friday, earlier today. And as always, there was at least one question about Adrian Peterson.
This is a team that has a Pro Bowl running back.
I know. I don't get it. I mean, I don't get it from a football perspective, and I certainly don't get it from a human perspective. My goodness. I mean, from a football perspective, okay, yeah, I can see the Cowboys signing Greg Hardy, and I can see, and they there are protections in the contract to where if he messes up, they can get rid of him immediately and not incur any kind, you know, any kind of dead money, as it were, because like if it was a traditional contract, once he was on the 53-man coming out of training camp, he'd be they'd owe him the entire sum for the course of the year, even if he had disciplinary, and even if he had disciplinary issue, unless he had a suspension from the league, which may still come up, by the way. He may have a multi-game suspension looming for his actions in the past.
I'd like to see some transparency, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of a conviction makes it a bit more difficult. Like, one of the things...
But Ben Roethlisberger got a suspension for a quarter of a season, and he wasn't convicted of anything either. So the league has shown it will drop the hammer on guys, even if there's not an actual conviction in a court of law.
One of the things that, when I look back at professional athletes in general who have had huge issues, and one of those that comes to the forefront is Michael Vick, who was convicted and went to prison for, I guess it was a little over a year, something like that.
In the end, he missed two seasons. He went to prison in 07 and was... I think he got out early in 09 and then went to a halfway house before he got actually released.
Now, I didn't really have much of a rooting interest for him. I mean, I was a fan of the Panthers. He was a rival. He always was great against the Panthers for whatever reason.
But he was great against the Broncos, too, in the one game he played against them as a Falcon back in 04. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, you can't think about Michael Vick without thinking about what he was eventually convicted of. But yeah, Halloween 2004 comes in, shreds him, 41-28. A game also, remember, for Darius Watts drop at the goal line, but that's neither here nor there.
Now, one of the things about him, though, is that after his conviction, after he came back, he made a huge concerted effort in talking to people about what he did.
He was working with PETA, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Well,
Or volunteered. Not like working, drawing a paycheck, but I thought he was doing some stuff with PETA and animal shelters and humane societies and things like that.
From what I remember, he did a lot of work just after that, after it all fell out for him. Mm-hmm. And that's something I really appreciate, is that it wasn't just lip service. It wasn't just money thrown at it. I mean, he obviously had some good, I don't know, maybe he had a good consultant who said you need to do all these things, but it's more than sometimes we see even today.
Well, ideally, the goal of the correctional system is to A, right, correct, and B, rehabilitate. I'll give credit to Michael Vick. He clearly appears to have taken the rehabilitation part of that seriously since he got out of prison. And I think and it certainly made him viable professionally, but I think it also made him a better person. So I'm not going to sit here and say that you can't change. I mean, even, you know, Rod Smith, a guy who's, you know, well regarded around here, you know, he had a domestic violence incident early in his career, but to his credit, he got himself on the straight and narrow. He was very public about it, actually made an appearance on Oprah Winfrey talking about it and how he learned from it and how it was not going to be repeated. He was very, very candid about what contributed to that and very contrite and really emerged as a changed person. Like, when it's interesting, and to the point where now to this day, his counsel still carries a great deal of weight in this building. And I think, frankly, the fact that he made those mistakes early in his career and he owned up to them and he grew from them and he didn't repeat them makes the advice that he gives players around in this building, gives it more weight than if he'd just been completely clean and never slipped up over the course of his career.
And ultimately, that will be what decides the fate of a lot of these players, is how they take these, you know, I don't know how to put it without a conviction, how they take these troubles and reshape their lives about it.
You know, they say everyone deserves a second chance.
And you know how that second chance shapes up.
The problem is when we start seeing third, fourth, and fifth chances, I think. You know, like when a guy has multiple DUIs or alcohol-related offenses, you know, or a Josh Gordon, you know. Now, I think there's probably some addiction issues there that he needs to confront. And we actually, even though it's not on the same level of domestic abuse, Randy Gregory heading into the draft, you know, says interviewee has a positive marijuana test. That's, I don't think that compares to the type, in terms of gravity, the types of issues that we're discussing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, that's still a substance that's going to get you suspended in the league, and doing it right before the combine, there's going to be ample questions about, ample and justifiable questions about his character.
How serious.
Are you addicted? I mean, you can argue that if you know that this is a time of your life where you've got to stay away from it and you still indulge, is that a sign of an addiction that's going to cause problems in the future?
Obviously, this is going to be a hard topic to transition away from, but I felt like that was a pretty necessary avenue that we needed to go down, and not just for us, but for sports fans everywhere. This is a era where we need to become a little bit more, what's the word, aware.
Aware. That's exactly what I was going to use, is aware.
And so, not just in sports. This is in general.
But sports can set a positive example. I mean, it doesn't take more than a cursory glance to see the times when sports did set an example. You know, whether you're talking about, you know, Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the Olympics in 1968,
or the Olympics the other year in Russia with LGBT.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I mean, there are avenues in which the sports and athletes can make statements and can be leaders. I mean, for better or for worse, it's a microcosm of society. Mm-hmm. You know, domestic abuse happens outside of football. You know, it happens inside of football. But this sport isn't as popular and as adored as it is by the American public. It's in a position to show some leadership, and I think, you know, we can argue what the league does right and what the league does wrong, but I think on this issue, they're starting to see the light a little bit. I think they've made some mistakes, but I think they're trying to correct them going forward and make sure that there's proper punishment and proper weight given to, you know, proper weight given to this issue more so than in the past.
Now, they've looked at making some of those changes at these meetings. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's some other changes to come out of it, some dealing with concussion policy and just trying to be on the safe side when they notice players who might be a little discombobulated or
good word, discombobulated.
Yeah.
And accurate, if you look back at the Super Bowl, I think everyone's calling it the Julian Edelman rule, basically, that he, you know, took a hit, looked a bit woozy, stayed in the game, caught what was eventually the game-winning touchdown, but should he have been out there for his own
safety
and his own health? And now the spotter, there's been a concussion spotter in the league or in the press box the last few years, but now that spotter is going to be able to buzz down to the official and say, this player doesn't look good. He has to come out. He needs to be have an evaluation at some point now.
Obviously, it's a step forward.
Yeah, it's a step forward because, you know, more and more you're seeing the NFL rely upon independent medical professionals for diagnosis and treatment. We see that for a player to go through to pass the post-concussion protocol, he has to be examined and cleared by an independent neurologist who does not work for the team, does not work with the league. And this spotter, you know, again, is independent of the teams, so they can, you know, that spotter can make that call. If the team doesn't see, and also don't forget the spot, you know the people, you know, the coaches and doctors and trainers, you know, they're on the sideline and they're monitoring, but it's not always the best view that they have. If the spotter's looking up and sees a guy kind of wobbling a bit, and people on the sideline don't notice, then it's another set of eyes that's watching out for the health and safety of the players, and now is able to do something more proactive than in the past.
That was probably the biggest change, I think, that came out of these meetings. Obviously, mm-hmm. Some of them got tabled for, I think,
extra points. Yeah, that's
extra points was a big point of contention.
And that
but not intended.
And it looks like something's going to happen there, whether it's moving it back to the 15-yard line on,
or as small as just making it making defenses able to score on an interception.
I don't know why that hasn't been the case all along.
Yeah.
Ever since college added that, I thought the pros should have added that just in the snap of a finger. Just, you know, you probably have you have a chance to score on a block kick as well as on an interception or on a fumble. So it just spices it up a little bit.
Well, frankly, I think if obviously this is just kind of me thinking out loud, but if a defense is going to return an interception 100 yards or a fumble 100 yards, shouldn't you give them more than a point or two?
Well, yeah, if you have that play and say, okay, the maximum anyone can get is 2 points. If one team goes to one end, if a team goes to one end zone or a team goes to the other end zone, you're scoring two. So you can kind of
it's like 2 yards versus.
I know, but the same. But in any play from scrimmage, there's a possibility of the offense or the defense scoring 6 points.
Right.
And that's the maximum, no matter what they do. So I think
I've always preferred the collegiate rule that you can score on as a defense.
But college on conversions over the years has always tended to be the head of the NFL because they had the 2-point conversion for decades before the NFL finally made it a part of its game in the 1994 season. It's actually funny to think of an NFL without 2-point conversions. It seems so ancient that the league played, 70 some odd years without a 2-point conversion as a possibility. So it's part of the evolution of the game. What I think is interesting is if you kicked PATs back to where it's a 33-yard 15 for the line of scrimmage and it's a 33-yard field goal, you pretty much take the possibility of a fake out of it. Not that teams were faking on extra points very much, but and actually, little tidbit, before you had 2-point conversions, you could still run for 1 point or pass for 1 point. It was I was at a game in 1989 where Chicago played Tampa Bay. And the snap was high, and Chris Moore, the punter, fielded it, but couldn't get the snap down for the PAT. So he just turned around, ran for the pylon, and got in, and they got 1 point.
Sacrificing your body for 1 point must feel a little foolish.
It was a very good job by Moore to know the rules. Had to know that just because you couldn't get the snap down didn't mean you couldn't still find a way to get the point at that time. But
kicking it's probably an easier
avenue. A little bit.
You might not want to go for the
easier, less stressful, more reliable. Now that being said, some of the radical suggestions on PATs like and 2-point conversions, like the one that suggested, if you get the 2-point conversion, you get a bonus point and get on a 50-yard place kick. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. That was the Colts who suggested that. And I'm waiting for a team.
I like these more wild ideas, though.
I'm waiting for a team to suggest that if you have a kickoff and you send it through the uprights, you get a point.
Well, Graham,
said yes.
Let's do it.
Yes, exactly. Not quite the Canadian football style rouge where any touchback ends up being a point. That would be a little too much. But hey, I think that would certainly change the tenor of games at Sports Authority Field, given how often kickers blast the ball out of the end zone. I mean, when the Ravens come into to Denver for a game with Justin Tucker, you might as well give them, if you assume they're going to have 4 kickoffs in a game, you might as well give them 4 points right off the bat.
Well, for the excitement that they've kind of lost by moving kickoffs in a bit, there you go. You can gain some of it back by having them kick for points.
And then
you start the game. You scoring.
And it makes possible a final score of 35-1. Right now, 1 point is the only score that you cannot have in an NFL game.
If they change it so that you can return,
it'd be two.
I thought it was one.
No, in college you get two.
Well, I know, but I thought they were going to change it to one.
And that would be stupid to me. If you're having a conversion, if the offense can get 2 points, the defense should be able to get 2 points. That's only fair. There are too many rules in place in the league right now that favor the offense over the defense. So that, and if you did that, give the defense a chance. You know, all we are saying is give D a chance. Sorry, folks.
All right, Mace. Well, with that little song, I think we'll end the podcast.
Mercifully.
Yes. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. As always, podcast is on iTunes. It's on the website. We'll catch you all next week as we get another week closer to the draft. We're continuing our draft coverage on DenverBroncos.com. Week by week, position assessments, sweepers, top picks, et cetera.
Best fit. And profiles, a lot of good videos, so check it out.
All the analysis that you need. So we'll catch you all next week. Thanks for tuning in. Ben and Mace, signing off.